entities and the entire inter-agency working group on illicit financial flows, the staff of parliament, media and the public. You are welcome. And let me also officially open this meeting. The meeting is about the briefing by the Inter-Agency Working Group, IAWG, on illicit financial flows. I think it will also include the tax havens and what is this other one? I don't remember it now. But anything that have to do with evading tax and people take money out of the country. We have witnessed that if you analyze the revenue collection, that there are so many tax evaders to an extent that if all taxpayers were compliant, by now the revenue collection will be 2.something trillion rand. But as of now, we stand at, is it 1.9 trillion? So this is a matter that has to be dealt with seriously so, because you can't make money here and take that money, very same money, and go and spend it somewhere else. Because the rent must revolve in this country. And the other issue, I think it was raised by the minister when presenting the budget, is the foreign nationals who have got businesses in South Africa which are not registered. I'm not sure whether that's the competence of DTI or small enterprises. But do they pay tax? Well, that's some regulation falls somewhere else. But with us here, we're interested in the revenue collection. Do they pay tax? Because they are all over, in the rural areas, in the townships. And collectively, they generate lots of money. It might look like it's a container at the corner of a street, but how many containers do we have from Cape Town to Messina? How many of them operate from garages? Also, the other question is, are they real small? Or there are other bigger forces behind them? Because on a face value, you will think you'll deal with somebody who's small because you come across him at the container. But only to find it's a network of a very big business which is disaggregated into small operations. But there is a bigger force behind them. So we can't have a country where there are enterprises which exempt themselves from tax contributions. Because gradually you will begin to have every sector regulating itself. And you will reach a state where it's like the state has got no capacity to regulate either business or other activities. And that will be a recipe for disaster, because we don't want a failed state. So the state, through its apparatus, must make sure that the laws of the republic, we have to obey them. No one should be exempted from obeying the laws of the Republic. All of us who are here, we pay taxes, we make tax returns. But why is it that those who make lots of money exempt themselves? So we believe, because this matter has been discussed several times, that you will give us a comprehensive report to deal with this issue. We raised it in our debate last week when we presented the fiscal framework report. And I believe even tomorrow it will be raised when we debate the division of revenue bill in the National Assembly. So it's a matter that is of concern to the public and the government, of course. Let's go to apologies. I've got apologies of Honorable Lewis and George, and Morolong is on his way. Do we have other apologies? Nkosi Buthelezi. Okay, Nkosi Buthelezi is not here. He has apologized. Honorable Abrams.
Honorable Bomo has a situation at her home. So, yeah.
Honorable Komo Zanel, apologize. Okay. Let's move to the main item, which is the briefing by the inter-agency working group. I think it will be FIC. I'm not sure. The chief of the FIC called me last week and said we must have this meeting. So I promised her that we'll have this meeting. So I suspect she's the leader in terms of briefing. But let me not impose her on the group and say that the group head should brief us now. Over to you, group.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thank you to the members of the committee. Honorable Chair, as you can see, we've got the FIC here, we've got the South African Reserve Bank, we've got the Hawks, we've got the SARS Commissioner is here. We also have the Financial Sector Conduct Authority in the working group. We have the Special Investigative Unit, and we also have an NPA. I must register an apology from the NPA. This is a working group that was formed after we have appeared in front of this committee, and we asked whether we are really coordinated in fighting illicit financial flows. We were here last year and we made a presentation and we said we've already done a case selection and a case selection criteria, and we're able to identify about 8 big cases where we really need to work together in an integrated fashion and show effectiveness. So the purpose of this presentation is just to apprise you of progress in dealing with these matters. The working group is chaired by the FIC. Dr. Masiabato is here with me, who chairs the working group. And meetings are being held at the FIC. FIC is also the secretariat. And FIC will be giving the presentation on these matters. But outside the cases that are sitting in the illicit financial working group, each office is also dealing with illicit financial flow matters falling within the scope or the case selection criteria of the cases that are sitting in the working group. But for the purposes of today's meeting, if the chair allows us, it will only be the FIC and the Reserve Bank that will touch on those cases. I think in future we'll really appreciate some direction from the chairperson whether you'll want each and every person to deal with the cases that are falling within illicit financial flows but are outside of this working group. Chairperson, we had 8 cases last year, but our number of cases have now gone up to 10. And the reason we now have 10 cases is because there is progress in this working group. Collaboration is very much effective, and 2 of the 8 cases have already been finalized. Hence, we decided to add case number 9 and 10. But you'll see that from the cases that I guess everybody knows that it takes quite a long time to finalize a criminal investigation and a criminal prosecution. But when it comes to the freezing the civil proceedings, the forfeiture, it really doesn't take that long, especially when you don't do a criminal-based forfeiture. We decided to add 2 cases because we had finalized 2, but those cases that we have not finalized, you see that 1 case is already final forfeiture, that is case number 3. And 3 other cases we have already blocked or frozen funds. The others are still at an early phase. So we're quite happy with the progress in this working group. I'll start with by giving the background, and I'll ask Dr. Masiabato to go into details on the 10 cases, and Mr. Peter Alberts will deal with the role of the FIC outside these matters. On slide 4, we try to give a background and the definition of illicit financial flows. Carr, the lead economist at Global Financial Integrity, defines illicit financial flows or illicit money as money that is illegally earned, transferred, or utilized, but somewhere between its origin, use, or movement, this money breaks laws, hence it's called illicit. And the United Nations Development Programme, in their definition, they say illicit financial flows include, but not limited to, cross-border transfers of proceeds of tax evasion, corruption, trade in contraband goods, and criminal activities such as drug trafficking and counterfeiting. The global footprint, if you look on your right on slide 4, you'll see that from the capital flight, illicit financial flows, you'll have the illicit and the licit. But from the illicit, 5% of the illicit financial flows is money that represents proceeds generated from the crime of corruption. And 35% represents proceeds generated from criminal activities such as the drug trade. And 60% is proceeds from tax evasion, which is a big chunk. And we believe, as the country, we're not really far from this picture. The UN Economic Commission, the high-level panel on IFFs, others call it the Thabo Mbeki panel, its findings were that about $50 billion per annum leaves Africa, and that is $50 billion of illicit financial flow. But the biggest challenge with this is that ODAA says the money that we get as the continent is funding from jurisdictions that can really afford to fund us. Twice of that is lost by the continent due to illicit financial flows, which means no jurisdiction that is really willing to find us will be encouraged to fund us, knowing that the funding that we receive, we lose it through illicit financial flows. Hence, we need to really fight this scourge. And the IMF also confirms this figure if you read their reports. I'll just take you to the next slide. The next slide, if you look at the inner circle on top, is the informal economy, which includes, this is the economy that is not regulated, that doesn't pay tax. It includes your SPASA, Shibins, NGOs. If you can say how many NGOs are you having in a country, it's like asking how many fish do you have in the sea. Churches, the taxes, even though you can say they are legal, but they are not really regulated, hence they are falling under that circle that is called informal economy. But below that, it's the one that is definitely illicit, the informal one. The outside circle on top is the formal economy that is taxed, that is monitored and regulated. But if you look at the bottom represents the information that we, all of us as a collective really, are able to access information that is sitting with us in the, and assist us in identifying proceeds and assist us really when we are investigating or dealing with these matters. I'll therefore ask Dr. Masiabato to take us through the 10 cases that we have in this illicit financial flows working group. Thanks, Dr. Masiabato.
Thanks, Director. Thanks, Chairperson and honorable members and colleagues. As the Director had indicated, I'm the chair of the Interagency Working Group that is mainly looking after the actual investigations in terms of the cases that we seek to be working on. But before I go to the cases, Honorable Chair and members, to update you in terms of where we are, it is always very important just to remind ourselves structurally in terms of where we are sitting. If you look into the slide number 8, you will note that there is illicit financial flows inter-agency working group. As I've indicated, that's what I chair. But of course, that is the sitting that is in the middle of the value chain. Below that, we have the operational inter-agency working group. The operational one is actually where the actual investigators are, and that is where they actually do the actual investigations. And of course, in terms of accounting, on the top part, you will see we have the interdepartmental working group on anti-money laundering as well as countering the financing of terrorism. That is the structure that is made up of the DGs. Those are the people that we account to in terms of the actual implementation of the work that we are actually doing on the ground, but still making sure that the investigators are insulated from the accountabilities in terms of the workings of on the ground in terms of the investigation in as far as the matters are concerned. If you move to slide number 9, Chair, you will note that we had to say that arising from the definition which the Director has spoken to, which is effectively a representation of the global explanation in terms of the definition itself, we had to also say that as a country, we had to also adopt our own definition. And the reason why we had to do that is was to be able to contextualize our work and be able to know what is it that we call illicit financial flows. So, based on the global definitions, you will note that there is a definition that says illicit financial flows will be the money that is illegally earned, but of course, its circulation can be domestic and of course, in certain cases, exit the domestic jurisdiction to other foreign jurisdictions. So, in our own definition, we had adopted a definition that is about the illegal movement of money or capital flows from one country to another, mainly being illegally earned or illegally transferred or illegally utilized. So in that context, you will note that in terms of the following bullet there, it basically indicates that for the illegally earned money is a very conventional one. We have a piece of legislation that we acronym it as POCA, that is the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, and that is the one that effectively criminalizes money laundering, and that is the one that deals specifically with the money that is being illegally earned, and that one is very explicit. But of course, there are instances where the money becomes legally earned, but effectively gets illegally actually transferred, or it breaks the laws in between. And that is what we also look at in as far as dealing with that particular area of work. And in this context, you can note the issues about the cash mules, which is our biggest problem that we have to be dealing with. Now, before I go to the cases, it is very important for the committee members to note that we had to create a business unusual model, which had to define the work that we have to do as an inter-agency working group. And that is, we had to then develop a case selection criteria. And the reason why we had to do that is because, one, there is various responsibilities done by various agencies among ourselves to deal with issues of illicit financial flows. And in that context, they had to be dealing with those work in their respective areas of work. So our coordination work had to be defined for it to be able to actually have context. So in that context, we are saying we will be in the inter-agency working group able to roll in a case that is, one, fall within the definition of illicit financial flows as defined on top. Secondly, in terms of the working group, we are then rolling out only cases where the minimum financial threshold is 100 million. And above. So what that basically means is that any other cases of illicit financial flows below 100 million get dealt with by the respective individual agencies, but of course with the participation of the rest of us. But it is not necessarily rolled in conventionally in the working group. And the third criteria in terms of the working group is that it has to be a case that is mainly being investigated by three different agencies in particular. And that is primarily the case that cuts across a number of, or countering a number of legislative provisions, as it were. And of course, on that basis, we are saying all other cases falling outside this criteria had to be effectively dealt with by the individual agencies, as it were. Now, the next slide then goes into now the actual cases that we need to be briefing yourselves on. But I think the chair and obviously the honourable members will note that because the majority of these cases are currently under real investigation as we speak, our updating that we'll be making to yourselves is not going to be as operational or as detailed as it is in a way supposed to be, on the basis of ensuring that we do not compromise the current work that is being done by the colleagues. But of course, we will keep it at the level appropriate for you to be able to appreciate where we are. The first case, if you note, we basically termed them IFF 1, meaning that is the case number 1, stroke 2018, meaning the year in which the case was enrolled in the inter-agency working group. So the first case for the purposes of this engagement, Honorable Chair, is a case that has to do with Ponzi schemes, you know, as it were, which is one of the most difficult things that we have to be dealing with as a country to get them dealt with. And in that context, over 126 million had effectively been exported out of South Africa. And of course, in terms of the work that is being done around there is mainly by the Reserve Bank, the AFU, NPA, SAPS, DPCI, SARS, as well as the FIC. So it's basically a case that involves fully all of us, as it were. Just for the context of the status, it is important to note that the suspects around this particular case were effectively arrested and they were released on bail. And of course, as we speak now, they had been remanded to come before the judiciary in May 2020. Currently, there is some work that is being done mainly by the NPA in terms of preparing the mutual legal assistance to be able to get some of the issues that needs to be repatriated from a foreign jurisdiction, as it were. And of course, the rest of the colleagues are doing the path that they need to be doing. And of course, the rest of the operational work continues in making sure that we do the freezing, that are supposed to actually happen and ultimately ensure the four features that are supposed to. If we go to the next slide, Honorable Chair, this particular case involves what we call exchange controls contravention. So in this context is actually the case where money was effectively, you know, exported out of the country outside the formal legislative framework in terms of the exchange controls provisions. And at this point, the country lost over 700 million, as it were, which was effectively exited out of the Republic. And in terms of the agencies, it involves the rest of us. So what we can be able to say now, in as far as this part is concerned, is that the Reserve Bank has been able to, up to this point, freeze over 42 million in as far as this particular issue is concerned. And of course, the issue obviously also involves issues of price mispricing, misinvoicing, which is one of those critical issues that we continue to be dealing with. And of course, the forfeitures, as I've indicated, are going to be unfolding in as far as this case is concerned. In terms of IFF 3, this one is mainly, again, on issues of exchange control contraventions. And in this particular one, as a country, we lost over 397 million, which was also exported out of the country. And of course, the case itself, as I've indicated, even with the previous one, it involves the majority of us in terms of ensuring that we are able to address in as far as this part is concerned. In this particular one, at least we managed to have 9.3 million being forfeited, mainly by the work done by our colleagues in the South African Reserve Bank. And of course, in this particular context, SARS is hard at work, looking at the whole issues of under-declarations, as well as issues of price misinvoicing, which is almost similar to the previous one that we are basically looking at. As we speak, the Hawks are leading the process on the ground in terms of investigation work, in terms of criminal investigations, and everything is in path in terms of where we are in as far as that part is concerned. Asset Forfeiture Unit is also looking into their part relating to forfeiture, you know, as it were. Looking into slide number 18, IFF 4, in this particular one, this is mainly around the issues of the transfer of the illicit proceeds arising from the transnational movement of funds relating to Rhino Horn, which you will know is one of those issues that we are worried about as a country, particularly the whole issue of, you know, Rhino Horn, as it were. And in this context, over 2.7 billion effectively had been exported out of the country through a voucher system. And of course, the money arose out of the rhino poaching, as it were. It does involve the rest of us in as far as this case is concerned, but we are effectively on the ground continuing with the investigations in as far as this part is concerned. And of course, one good progress in as far as this particular case is that we were able to convict one suspect who has been, in a way, found to be in possession of rhino horns illegally, you know, as it were, in the country. If we move to slide number 19, that is where IFF 5 is. This particular one is about something that is really very complicated to deal with, and that is the utilization of what is described as the hawala system, which I suppose some of the committee members will probably be aware of. And in this context, as a country, we lost in excess of 100 million South African rands. This particular case involves the rest of us, and we continue to do some work in as far as this part is concerned. And of course, as I had indicated earlier, because most of these cases do involve foreign jurisdictions, we do interact with our stakeholders, you know, outside our jurisdiction in as far as these matters are concerned. And in this particular one, we are effectively doing close collaboration investigative work with our colleagues in the U.S. Homeland Security, as it were. And of course, there is some work, as I've indicated earlier, in terms of asset forfeiture, looking into whether there could be a possibility to get some of those monies effectively addressed. SARS also continues to do their own part of work, particularly in terms of the tax audit-related work in making sure that we are able to you know, retrieve the files that are supposed to be to the fiscus, as the chair had indicated, which is one of those issues that, as this working group, we are fairly closely looking at on a closer basis. And of course, if we move to slide number 20, chair, as well as committee members, this is IFF 6. This one basically has to do with cash seizures at the port of entry. This is the case of what we describe as the cash mules. This is one of the most difficult issues that we have to be dealing with, and this is about the explicit, you know, movement of cash on briefcases and the like. And we are able to ensure that even that part of the loop actually gets closed. In this particular case, we are able to see that over 100 million, again in excess, had actually been lost in the country. But of course, in this particular case, we're able to at least detain and hand over almost 67 million rand that were seized in the port of entry, and in this context, the most critical port of entry being OR Tambo International Airport in Joburg, and in that context, we're able to get that money back into the system. And of course, we have also spoken to our colleagues in the law enforcement space broadly to intensify the way in which we interface with the travelers in terms of ensuring that we are able to pick up in cases where people have large volumes of cash that effectively need to be looked at. And of course, in this particular context, we are also able to indicate that out of the seven, you know, cases that we are working on now, we also got to realize that there is a linkage between the actual role players in as far as these issues is concerned, together with the attorneys, for instance, where we had an instance where there has been cases where one attorney has been representing most of the suspects picked up in this context. And that gave us some possible link in terms of some kind of an organized nature in as far as the matter is concerned. But of course, the colleagues on the ground are making sure that that issue is effectively untangled. In terms of IFF 7, as it were, this one is purely on the issues of money laundering as well as corruption. So in this particular case, we are also able to indicate that an excess of 100 million has also been lost by the country, as it were. And of course, in terms of where we are now, we have the main suspect being effectively put through into the system, criminally so, and been charged, and as we speak, is serving 8 years in prison, as it were. Now, in this particular one, we are basically able to say that the corruption element or the corruption side of this particular case is effectively completed as the culprit is being sentenced to prison. And this is one of the cases that the director had indicated that we had effectively closed. Although we are continuing to look into the money laundering side of things to be able to pick up, if we can pick up other suspects in as far as this particular case is concerned. But we have obviously on the corruption side kind of fairly get it closed, and the closure report has been presented into the inter-agency working group, and we are effectively, in a way, happy in as far as that part is concerned. In terms of IFF 8, which is in slide 22, there we are basically talking about an organized crime syndicate, highly complicated one, that we've been dealing with from 2018, and we are still on the ground doing some work on this one. Over 2.7 billion has been lost by the country in as far as this particular case, and of course the rest of the role players within the inter-agency working group are effectively involved in as far as this part is concerned. So in this context, we had instances where actually money had conventionally been moved through the South African banking system into a foreign jurisdiction. And in this context, at least we are able to ensure that we are able to effectively work on this one. Because once there are movement within the formal financial system, it becomes easier. Because as the Financial Intelligence Center, in that space, we are able to have a closer collaboration with the banking community and be able to make sure that those areas effectively get addressed. And of course, it becomes more difficult when those things actually are happening outside the financial system. So in this context, we can effectively indicate that over 147 bank accounts had been effectively identified, and we are doing work with the community in the banking side of things to make sure that we have all of those issues addressed. As we speak, 175 accounts had been blocked and over 2.7 million had been put back into the fiscus to get all of that issue effectively addressed. Now, on the basis of the blockage that actually had unfolded, in as far as this part is concerned, we had partially, in a way, closed this part of the case, as it were. And these are the two cases that Dr. spoke about, which is IFF 7 as well as IFF 8. As I move towards conclusion, Honorable Chair, in terms of the cases, I will just indicate that we have added IFF 9. As you can see, they were added towards the latter part of 2019, as well as IFF 10. So these are fairly new cases that we are currently doing a lot of work on the ground. So in terms of IFF 9, it's truly what we call Project Travel, and that is the case that we are looking at. 2.5 billion being lost through, and in that context, at least even in these initial stages, we're able to block 78 million by our colleagues at the Reserve Bank, and that is actually a very good progress that we can be able to report in a very short space of time, by the way. And of course, as you can see, we are also indicating that we are doing some bit of operational work relating to this. As I've indicated, it's a bit of a new case. We are basically looking at all the possible fellows or suspects around the issue, as it were, and we will be able to progress very well in as far as that part is concerned. The last case, Honorable Chair and colleagues, this one is again the Hawala issue that I referred to earlier, and this is Project Hawala. In this context, 150 million has been lost, and of course the rest of us are involved in as far as this part is concerned. And again, I indicated it is a new case, and we are continuing to do some bit of work on that. Again, another good progress, we're able to block over 73.3 million by our colleagues from the Reserve Bank, and of course the rest of the stakeholders, ourselves as well as law enforcement, are busy on the ground making sure that we identify the critical role players in as far as this part is concerned, so that we can effectively be able to get all this addressed. If you look at slide number 25, it gives some bit of a summary in terms of 25. Well, yeah, that's okay. So in terms of where we are now, this is, let's go to the next. Yeah, this is the slide. So this is the summary, and that basically reflects on how much we were able up to this point to have back into the system in terms of the preservation orders processes. As you can see there, we have over 71M on top there, and we have 78 million and all of those figures according to the various cases that one had reflected on, and we are now sitting at 400 million as it were. The next slide is the slide that just generally reflects on the workings of the FIC in terms of supporting the inter-agency working group. And in this particular slide, you can see that we are talking to the kind of work that has been put on the table, trying to account in terms of the workings by the Financial Intelligence Center. 32 proactive disclosures, or what we call proactive financial intelligence reports, were issued in supporting law enforcement in making sure that we are able to deal with these issues. And we have 17 in terms of the reactive financial intelligence reports. These are the ones that they've requested for us to help them with. So we had effectively issued over 49 financial intelligence reports in supporting the work of the inter-agency working group across the various stakeholders to get all of these issues. And the next part of the statistical provision, they just indicate that we have dealt with over 40 individuals. We have dealt with, 52 all in all, and we have dealt with around 326 entities that has been effectively involved in as far as these issues are concerned. And of course, we have analyzed over 76 suspicious transaction reports that were effectively sent to the Financial Intelligence Center coming from the banking community that we have to be dealing with. Now, the next part of the presentation is the part that talks about the contribution of the Financial Intelligence Center that is to be dealing with cases that are outside the working group itself. And then Mr. Peter Alberts will then make through that presentation as the director indicated. Peter?
Thank you, Dr. Masiapatu. Honourable Chair, Honourable Committee Members, so as Dr. Masiapatu indicated, I will be touching on what is our involvement in illicit financial flow outside of the illicit or in terms of the interagency working group. So what is our business as usual from the financial intelligence side? So I want to take it to slide number 15. So how do we as the Financial Intelligence Center interact with business in general? So the Financial Intelligence Center Act is one of the sets of legislation that deals with money laundering and the financing of terrorism in South Africa. But it also provides for... It also provides for certain businesses that we regard as vulnerable for money laundering and could be abused for money laundering purposes. So typically these categories of businesses will receive property on behalf of an individual, and in that process the money gets laundered through the financial system. So we've got currently about 45,000 institutions registered with the Financial Intelligence Center, and these guys are actively reporting information into the Financial Intelligence Center. So we, by default, we look at estate agents, the banks. We've recently concluded what we call a charter with the banking community, which we call SAMLIT, the South African Money Laundering Integrated Task Force, which will help us to closely collaborate with the banking community in terms of reporting, but also in terms of collecting valuable financial intelligence for law enforcement in the investigation process. Also, the attorneys is one of the reporters of information to the Financial Intelligence Center. The gambling community, what we picked up, these guys would typically try to launder the process through a gambling process and try to hide the origin of the monies. Also, the motor vehicle dealers and then money remitters, people that sending monies out, that has been abused by criminals in terms of trying to launder the proceeds of these monies. So in terms of the requirements, what do we expect of these guys? So typically they will identify their clients. That information is important when a financial investigation has been started for the investigators to understand who is behind a specific account. Also in terms of identifying a risk around their clients, one of the large banks has got millions of clients, so how do they identify which clients are of a higher risk? And they need to build some risk programs around these individuals. Also in terms of record keeping, they need to keep records of their clients, which typically feeds into an investigation of a financial nature, and that assists law enforcement in terms of their investigations. In terms of reporting, I will touch on it in the next slide. They need to register with us as the Financial Intelligence Center. As indicated, we've currently got about 45,000 institutions registered with ourselves. It's actively reporting information to the FRC, and that enables us to prepare financial intelligence reports for our counterparts in law enforcement. If the question would be, what is going to happen? What is the impact if these guys are not complying with our act? We've got an enforcement department that actually go out and do inspections with these institutions. In the last financial year, we've done about 800 of these inspections together with the other supervisory bodies like the Reserve Bank to ensure that these institutions are actually compliant with our act and are actually reporting the information to the Financial Intelligence Center and providing the information as the objective of the legislation. Then also in terms of a new phenomenon that we've picked up is the crypto asset service providers. So that's typically an exchange that's buying and selling cryptocurrencies. Currently we estimate there's about 15 of these guys in South Africa operating. Fortunate for the Financial Intelligence Center is that some of these and the big three already registered with the Financial Intelligence Center, and they're submitting information to us, which is very valuable in terms of investigation and in terms of tracing the proceeds of the crimes. In terms of regulatory reporting, so the information that's been submitted to the Financial Intelligence Center, we're getting annually up to an average of about 300,000 reports being submitted to us, which ultimately indicate a suspicion around a specific transaction, the client, or the conduct of the client. This is not a crime as yet. There's still a lot of work to be covered by the Financial Intelligence Center to analyze the information. But that ultimately allow us to access the transactional information that support the transaction and then provide that valuable information to our law enforcement counterparts. We also received about 5.5 million cash threshold reports, so typically when there's a transaction of 25,000 and above with an accountable institution, that information gets submitted to the Financial Intelligence Center. That information we used in current investigations, and it's made available to law enforcement in terms of their investigations. But it also allows us to, on a strategic level, look at the movement of cash and what happened to cash. In terms of the national risk assessment that's been done from in terms of our country, we've identified the risk around cash and the use of cash. So these type of data that's been submitted to us by institutions will allow us to analyze it in more detail and understand what has been done with this cash and what is the source of the cash. So we are limited to financial information from our side that's been reported to us, and then we can then send a follow-up request to institutions understanding the underpinning transaction or information pertaining to the matter. We don't have access to interviews, or we can't interview the subject of an investigation, or we can't obtain what we call statements or affidavits like law enforcement agencies. But typically we depend on the money flows, so we follow the money from our in terms of our mandate, and that information we then support law enforcement in terms of their investigations. We also have the ability to freeze some funds and block some funds if we suspect it's linked to the proceeds of a crime. And in the last year we've blocked about 52 million in terms of cases where we have a reasonable suspicion that these monies were linked to the proceeds of a crime. In terms of the next slide, so our involvement in terms of bulk cash matters, we typically worked on a number of these cases since 2017. And we've issued what we called financial intelligence reports on these matters. In a total of 26 reports were issued to four different agencies, and we've covered 209 individuals in these reports, which was linked to 225 entities, and which came from 77 different suspicious transaction reports that we've received from institutions registered with the FIC. In terms of my last slide, so when we start focusing on the flight of capital from South Africa and focusing on exchange control, we also received a copy of the cross-border flows of cross-border transactions from the Reserve Bank. This information gets analyzed and integrated with our other data sets. We worked since 2014 on a number of these matters, in total 64 matters, which was disseminated to four different agencies and covered 208 individuals and eight entities, which was related to more than 300 transactions. I will now hand over to the director.
Thank you, Peter. Going forward, we, as the FIC, were trying to really develop our systems to ensure that we've got better systems and intelligent systems that will enable us to really convert the data that we are sitting with, because we sit with a lot of information, into intelligence that we can really, and quality intelligence that we can share with law enforcement. We are also creating partnership with the private sector to ensure that they don't only report information to us, but they are also able to sit with us, especially on the big matters that we've identified, and assist us in really following the money. And we are also improving our collaboration with law enforcement agencies like your NPA, your SARS, your DPCI, you have heard about the fusion center, we have agreed that we'll just be able to sit together on those big cases that we have prioritized as our priorities, sit together in one room and really drive those cases to ensure that we are able to deliver in time. In those cases, we have also assigned very, very senior people to drive that project. And our main focus is not just your standalone money laundering. It's money laundering that involves state parties and money laundering that has cross-border elements. We are also trying to ensure that we've got access to all the relevant administrative, financial, and law enforcement information that we are supposed to be sitting with, so that we can be able to really produce intelligence that is up to date and that is of quality. There is information that we normally get from third parties, but we are saying let's approach the departments directly and get that information from them. I'll just refer to the collaboration that we have had with the RTMC to try to get the NATIS, access to NATIS. We are due to sign the MOU, but we've already agreed on access. We are busy communicating with the Master's Office, and we are looking into having a beneficial ownership register, because people hide their proceeds or their monies in trust, and you need to know really who is really in ultimate control of the trust, so that you can be able to get information that will assist law enforcement and identify really the real person who is calling the shots and who takes the decisions. And while looking bad as a country when it comes to the issues of beneficial ownership. Then the third issue is the issue of deeds. We are in communications with the deeds office. Home Affairs, the communications have reached a stage really where we are now having access, so it's very good collaboration. We have signed MOUs with the National Commissioner Stolle, with targets with the DPCI, good relations as I've mentioned, and we've signed MOU with the NPA, with SARS, with SIU, with State Security, with the Office of the Public Protector, and with the Reserve Bank. Thank you, Chairperson. I will now hand over to the Reserve Bank.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you some information on the work done by the Financial Surveillance Department of the South African Reserve Bank, specifically in the area of illicit financial flows or the illegal flow of funds cross-border. Our presentation will briefly deal with our enforcement powers, some of the enforcement actions that we've taken, collaboration with stakeholders, some specific interventions, and then we'll be happy to take questions from the honourable members at the end of the presentation. The Financial Surveillance Department of the South African Reserve Bank is empowered to investigate illicit foreign currency transactions and to take certain administrative actions against the perpetrators. These actions would include the blocking of funds, the attachment of money or assets, ultimately the forfeiture of such blocked funds or money or assets to the National Revenue Fund, and also the referral of certain matters to law enforcement for criminal investigation. Obviously, we do not have powers to do criminal investigations, but matters that are sufficiently motivated and that we feel can be investigate from a criminal perspective are referred to law enforcement. If we look at the period from the 1st of March 2019 to the 29th of February 2020, During this period, we've issued blocking orders to the value of 3.8 billion rand in 148 cases, and it involves funds blocked in 275 bank accounts. The forfeiture notice published in the similar period, 111.9 million, 50 cases, and the accounts from which the money forfeited, 73 accounts. I think I must also just explain that the blocking order is the first step in our intervention. Thereafter, we have to allow the involved parties the opportunity to state their case, and if we have sufficient evidence, we would eventually proceed to a forfeiture. So there will always be a cycle of blocking and a cycle of forfeiture, which will be slightly slower than the process of blocking. If we look at collaboration with our stakeholders and colleagues from other agencies, during this period we've received 43 reports or referrals from the FIC. We've requested assistance from the FIC in three particular matters. We also dealt with quite a number of inquiries from South African Revenue Services, Law Enforcement, National Prosecuting Authority, Asset Forfeiture Unit and Commission of Inquiry. And during this period, we've received 142 requests or subpoenas for information. The information that we normally provide would be records of cross-border transactions, simply because any cross-border transaction through the banking system, whether it's done through an EFT or whether you use your credit or debit card offshore, are reported to the South African Reserve Bank, and we have a complete record of those transactions. So we are in a position to supply that information to various agencies in terms of the applicable law for them to use in their investigative processes. We've also referred persons or entities to Revenue Services. 24 parties were referred, and those are in cases where we feel or we have grounds to believe that there may have been contraventions or non-compliance from a tax perspective or a VAT perspective, or even in some cases duties related to imports transactions. Our collaboration with stakeholders, I think our most important source of information would be our authorized dealers. Those are banks which have been authorized to buy and sell foreign currency. The position is that they are the first in line to see a particular transaction. They are required to know their client, they can see the business activities over the client's bank account, and they are in a position to report any suspicious cross-border foreign exchange activities to us at very short notice. The Prudential Authority, which are responsible for the regulation of banks as well as for the anti-money laundering compliance by banks, we share a lot of information because they're also part of in the Reserve Bank, and we also join them on inspections from time to time. Whenever we are invited or get the opportunity, we provide training to various stakeholders. In recent months, we've had quite a few requests from South African Police Services, as well as from the authorized dealer community, where we do provide training on specifically focusing on our regulations, as well as the type of modus operandi that we see in the illicit flow space when it comes to foreign exchange transactions. We were also invited by one of the universities, which are presenting a course in, I think it's an MPhil, in forensic investigation, or forensic crime and money laundering detection. We were given the opportunity to do an awareness session with this university and the students attending this particular course that they represent. Just on matters referred to law enforcement, and I think we must just understand that we've got an arrangement that we are provided on a quarterly basis with feedback, simply for sake of good order and to make sure that we do get the right feedback. We've referred over time a number of matters to law enforcement for investigation, specifically matters involving contraventions of the exchange store regulations. Six cases were closed with no result. Five cases we are still awaiting feedback. 38 investigations are still ongoing. Two matters are currently with the National Prosecuting Authority for decision. Five matters currently in court. Eight successful prosecutions. In six cases, cases were closed, but warrants of arrest were issued. And in seven matters, the NPA decided to withdraw or not to prosecute. I think we must also understand this also involves what we call a 419 matter, your advance fee fraud cases. So some of these cases are quite old, and the opportunity, I think, to trace these suspects may have passed, and that could be the reason why six cases were not really proceeded to prosecution, because they could not find the suspects. Just some recent interventions. We have currently, and I think everybody knows about Bitcoin or your crypto assets. We recently received information and investigated a particular case involving the purchase of crypto assets from a local exchange and transferring these assets offshore into a foreign wallet from where it's distributed to wherever the parties want their money to be paid. We've traced three main perpetrators or players in this arena, and we've issued blocking orders to date of around about 15 million rand. An illegal money transfer scheme that we're currently busy with is when numerous local entities effected payments based on falsified documents to common beneficiaries outside of South Africa, but these beneficiaries are also controlled by South African residents. The blocking orders at this point in time, 69.5 million. This is the one matter that was referred, and our colleagues from the FIC alluded, I think it's IFF 10. The simple reason why their blocking figure is 73 and our 69, we also blocked an amount in US dollars. At the time of blocking, the exchange rate was far more favorable, so we only got 69 million in rand terms, but with the recent changes in the exchange rate, obviously the dollar rand value of the dollar amount blocked will increase as the rand depreciates. But this is one of the matters that was referred to the Interagency Working Group for proper investigation by the various agencies. We also collaborated with the Asset Forfeiture Unit in a specific matter where we originally blocked approximately 22 million rand, and it has now been handed over by the AFU, obtained the necessary preservation orders, and they are proceeding with the investigation, hopefully to eventually forfeit the funds to the criminal asset recovery account. Thank you very much.
Chair, that concludes us.
Thank you, the team, for presenting on the illicit financial flows. Before I open for questions and questions for clarity and comments, do you have a comprehensive report on what you have presented? Because what you have presented is PowerPoint. It's not a report, actual report. Actual report should have a narrative. I hope you understand, advocate, what I mean. You are an advocate, you are used to drafting. So, is it possible? We acknowledge what you have presented. So, if, because we are not academics, we are parliamentarians, if we have to take this as a report of parliament, because we don't just discuss things, it ends here. We are parliament. They won't accept only a PowerPoint presentation. Because somebody who's not here will not follow if you just look at PowerPoint. So if it's possible, you might not have it now, make sure that you have got a narrative report that have got, because here you have singled out critical points, but if you can get us a proper report so that if we have to take it to the chamber, either for debate, but also for recording, because all what we do gets recorded and taken to the archive of Parliament. Members, that's the report that, if you remember last time, we were a bit hard on the team because they did not submit a comprehensive report by then. But I believe now we have a report which even goes to an extent of talking to figures. Because we're interested as to how much goes where. So, as I said, Advocate Kanyele called last week and said, we want to come to Parliament. She demanded this meeting. So I said, talk to Alan, Mr. Comit. So Alan and Advocate Kanyele agreed, despite coronavirus and everything, that this meeting must be held. So I complied. Members, comments, clarity, seeking questions. Honourable Sarupen, Honourable Morolong, Mhlonishwa, Skosana, Honourable Maviletsa, Honourable Abrams.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me just preface my remarks by saying that I'm an alternate on this committee, so if you presented in the past and my questions are duplicates of things that have been discussed in the past, I do apologize profusely. But, Chair, I have just five brief questions. First is, do our agencies here work with international investigation, prosecuting, and tax authorities? I saw a lot of local intergovernmental and interagency work, which is quite good, but I'd like to know how they work with international agencies to repatriate persons from prosecutions as well as recover monies. Then the second question I have is, how are we dealing with the illicit, with cash from the illicit tobacco industry, and are there any cases in that regard? Because this is one of those things that should actually be prioritized considering the sheer amount of investigative journalism going on around this, and considering that there are politically sensitive persons alleged to have been involved in this, it's important that equal standards are applied in dealing with that particular industry. And then around the proceeds of illegal mining and the value chain there and how it erodes value, are there any cases, have there been any cases in the past around that? My fourth question is around, do you take a holistic approach when looking at some of these illicit flows and looking at the entire supply chain from, you know, where the perhaps illicit goods are generated all the way through the exit of cash from the country and all the steps in between, the individuals involved, or is it just about following the money and recovering that? And then my last question is, there were comments about the fact that the agencies are dependent on law enforcement, they don't have subpoena power, they don't get to see statements and so on. So I'd like to know what teeth they currently have and what teeth, maybe in terms of legal terms, you need to be more effective in dealing with illicit financial flows and if there's perhaps maybe legislation that needs to be brought in that regard. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honourable Sarupen. Honourable Morolo.
Thank you very much. Mine is only one question. In your report, you alluded to the fact that the threshold that the agency is dealing with is 100 million. Why not 50 million? What are the reasons? Is it the global benchmark? You further went on to suggest that then the rest of, then below 100 million, there are agencies that are dealing with these cases. Can you disaggregate it? Can you expound further on which agencies are you referring to? And then you further said, and then you come in. That's why I said maybe you need to, maybe in your narrative report you would have done that. but because it is not there, maybe you need to just expound on it. How do you then feature below 100 million? Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Mrolo. Mhlonishwa Skhosana.
No, ngiyathokoza sihlalo ohloniphekileyo. No, we welcome the report from the inter-agency working group, and I think we are happy, I think, to realize that there's at least some kind of work that is being done in relation to this matter of illicit financial flows, because we are seriously worried as the committee, particularly when you look at the state of our economy and our inability to generate the required revenue as the country. I just want to check on the work of individual stakeholders in relation to illicit amounts or in relation to cases that are below the 100 million rand. As you have indicated that as a group, you are mainly focusing on cases that start from 100 million rands upward. And you said cases that are below that, individual stakeholders which are part of the working group, they are dealing with those particular cases. So I want to find out as to whether do you receive adequate reports from various stakeholders as to how far are they in dealing with those cases, because as much as those might be smaller cases, because they are dealing with a smaller amount, but because they are many, they might be contributing to a very big chunk of the illicit financial flow. Just want to find out on that. Secondly, you indicated that you had 8 cases. Now you are having 10, but out of the 10, you have concluded 2 of them. I see, but there's one case here, I think it's IFF8, which says that the case is concluded, but on the prosecution it says no. Well, I could not get the reason. I think while Dr. Masia was presenting as to what is the reason why there's no prosecution if the case indeed is concluded. Well, coming to the presentation of the South African Reserve Bank, I think we also welcome it. I think there's some work that has been done in collaboration with the South African Police Services. Well, in terms of slide 6, bullet number 1, it says there are 6 cases that are closed, but it further says no results. I don't know what does that mean. You say the 6 cases closed but no results. And there are also 5 cases which their status are unknown. Why is that so? If you are collaborating with the SAPS, I think my understanding would be you are timelessly briefed by the SAPS on these particular cases. So I just want clarity on these 2. But the last question also on the inter-agency working group, is SAPS part of the group? I've heard you mentioning Hawks, but is the SAPS in its entirety part of the working group? Thanks, Honorable Chair.
Thank you. I can see that a lot is being done, definitely. Given you know, the kind of the case that you are dealing with, you are working very well. I'm also on IFF8, but I just want to find out that you are saying 175 accounts have been blocked, and this side where you mention recoveries, you also under one IFF8 is 2.9 million. Does it mean that you don't only block, you recover that money? That's my question, because sometimes when the account is blocked, you find that the money is still hanging there. And on the agency as well, I see there's a lot of couple of blocks there. So my question is, do you only block and recover that money, or the money is still, you know, swimming somewhere there? Yeah, and what is it, that page? Yeah, slide number 7, you know, IFFS accounts,
accounts of three main players blocked, and, you know, that kind of question. So after blocking, do you take the money?
Thanks, Mthombe. Mphathiswa Abraham.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much. I also wish to really appreciate the mode of operation that has happened since the committee meeting. And I wish to echo what the chairperson also raised in terms of the report, because you'll find that sometimes we would ask clarity questions that are contained in the report. So I think the director was ready to answer that as well. Chair, just to follow up on the question by Honorable Morolong on slide 9 of the comprehensive report, the 100 million threshold for investigation and less to individual entities. My question is, while you begin to do the honorable work, the criminals also know what you are up to, and they tend to fall just below. It's like the 99 rands amount that they usually deduct from individuals, because they know the 100 will register, so they put in the 99. So are we conscious, and how have we planned to beat them at their game? And on the Ponzi scheme, I see that the suspects are arrested and remanded. Are they remanded until May 2020? Because also that's very shorthand, you know, and I missed the verbal explanation. And as that is on the slide that talks to cases, slide 10, right? And on the same point, the scheme, we also get a report that the charge sheet isn't drafting. Is it because the suspects were only arrested in 2020? And because I'm looking at that date, and I'm also looking at the case number date. The most painful, as you correctly alluded through your chair, is the movement of the rhino horn. And I'm really happy at how you are dealing with such cases, but the issue there is that there have been no recoveries in terms of the monetary term. I am not sure if there is that. What that means is that there is no progress. I see there's ongoing investigation. Because at some point, the money has to be paid back. Chair, another good and encouraging work is the work that's happening at the ports, because one can see that there's even more than 60% recovery. So that's good work, and as well as the issue of the corruption and money laundering, that's also very encouraging. Chair, my last take would be with the Reserve Bank and the kind of work that they do with the students. It's just that they indicate that they are working with the students per invitation. My sense would have been that maybe there could have been proactivity from the institution in terms of the work that's being done by the various tertiary institutions. How is that for a proposal? And my last would have been what Honorable Skhosana has posed in terms of the 6 and 5 cases, and maybe just to add what the total number of cases is, because you want to know if we're talking about 38 cases that are being investigated, out of how many cases are we talking? Thanks, Chair.
Siyabulela mhlonishwa. We'll have responses. After that, the Commissioner wants to make a short input. Then we'll take another round of comments and questions. Over to you, panel.
Thank you, Chair. I will request that you give us up until Monday to prepare a very detailed report. I'm asking for Monday because I need that report to incorporate all the cases that are falling outside the scope of the illicit financial flows working group. So by Wednesday, we will be forwarding that report to yourself. I'll first ask Dr. Masiabato to respond on all the cases, but before Dr. Masiabato responds, I'll try to respond to the first question on whether we do request assistance from foreign jurisdiction. I must say the NPA is part of us. In these cases, we also work with the Department of Justice when it comes to mutual legal assistance and getting information from foreign jurisdictions. South Africa is also a member of Egmont. Egmont, it's a group of FIUs that have been found to be in good standing when it comes to measures of combating money laundering. And as Egmont, if you're a member of Egmont, we are able to just phone you and be able to get information through our secure web. So we do get information. But in reality, there will be some of the jurisdictions will be very difficult. There will also be members of Egmont, but they will place restrictions really on you to get information. So some of them, especially when they are dealing with the same matter, they might find you as a risk that you want information that they are still dealing with, and they will prefer to finalize their case before they give you that information. But it helps if we are really financially capacitated, because we can be able to travel to these jurisdictions and say, we've been requesting and knocking on your doors, and you are not giving us what we are asking for, or you are delaying what's happening. So sometimes the financial capacity doesn't allow you to really do these visits and compare notes and sit with your counterparts, but we do really use mutual legal assistance in most of your cases. And there was another question on whether do we have teeth. If you can look at the reports, you'll see that we don't only freeze, which is the first phase. We freeze. After freezing, we get a final order, which is a forfeiture order. So that's where you hit criminals in their pockets. That's where it hurts the most. So there you definitely have teeth if you are able to do that. And we've got conventions that say don't only prosecute people, but also recover the proceeds that they've generated from crime. But you can also see that we don't say because we've forfeited or we're frozen, we're not going to do anything. SARS is still involved, so they still hit from their side. NPA is still involved. The police, the detectives, we've got Hoffs and we also have the detectives, they are still involved. Hence, you are hearing us saying the matter is still under investigation. Hence, you are hearing us saying the prosecutor is still drafting the charge sheet. It's because we don't only focus on the recoveries, but we also focus on prosecution. We have seen there are 2 cases where we are saying there are already convictions. So we are all really playing a role, and we've got teeth and very, very sharp ones. We use, when you do the financial investigation, you follow the money, but it doesn't mean you only follow the money. So you close all the gaps. If it requires you to really get the chain from A to B on how really money was flowing, and to get statements from supply chain, it depends really on what the case requires. Commissioner, on the issue of the illicit tobaccos, we really come towards the end, but we were here last year and we gave a presentation on the cases that we are dealing with in the area of illicit tobacco. So if you are requesting that presentation, we can forward it. It's a presentation that we did last year, or we can update it again and forward it to you. I'll then ask Dr. Masia, but on the issues of the threshold, we are not saying the cases that involve 99 million are not important. They are important. We are dealing with them. But in order to come up with a criteria, we had to say, let's look at the high-value cases. And the high-value cases, one of the criteria that we used was 100 million. But cases that are below that are still receiving attention. In the report that you are asking, Chairperson, will try to give really detailed information on what's happening in those cases, cases that are below 100 million. So just expect a very, very long report. Dr. Masiabadu, will you please touch on the cases, especially case number 8, IFF 8 of 2018. That we can hear the Reserve Bank on the issues of cases closed.
Thank you, Director. Honourable Committee, I just looked at the presentation we did in March last year in terms of illicit tobacco matters. From the Financial Intelligence Centre side, we worked on about 127 cases between 2014 and 2018, and we mostly supported SARS, Reserve Bank, SSA, and other agencies in terms of the investigations, and we've covered about 50 individuals and 350 entities in that specific matters. In terms of IFF 8, the specific matter is quite a complex matter. If you look at this, 2.7 billion, which was linked to about 2,000 bank accounts. And due to the analysis being done by the Reserve Bank, they were able to block some of the monies still in some of these accounts. So in terms of the matter, we're still working on the matter. But we will soon get a closer report from the Reserve Bank on the matter. The problem is if the money left the country to a specific jurisdiction or a jurisdiction, it's sometimes a challenge to... So we can request information from that jurisdiction and try to repatriate the money, but that is also a challenge for us.
The Reserve Bank on the issue of the six cases that are closed but under investigation.
Thank you. I think that the six closed is where, I must just also mention that the cases go back to, I think the oldest one is about 2012. Those are cases where we have not been able to obtain feedback as to what has transpired with the case. We'll continue following up on those matters, but I think that the issue that we also have is that these cases were reported to different units in the South African Police Service. We get our feedback mainly from the DPCI, and these cases were reported to various police stations. So we'll have to follow up, but it's very difficult, and we'll probably ask the DPCI if they could assist. Those with the status unknown are all cases reported specifically to the, we call them the 419 unit, which I think is the Advanced Fee Fraud Unit. We'll have to follow up with them. I don't have any feedback on those matters, and that's why we call them as status unknown. But we'll try and work out a better liaison process with law enforcement, because our problem is getting all of the investigating officers, and that's why we have the arrangement with the DPCI to do it on a quarterly basis. But we'll have to find a way, and that's a shortcoming that we'll have to address, to see how we can obtain that information. The second question was regarding the blocking of funds, and maybe just the procedure that we follow. Our investigation, our regulations state that Once you've achieved a position, we have reasonable ground to suspect that somebody has contravened or is in the process of contravening. We issue what's called a blocking order, and we try to issue it to the amount of the actual contravention that we have suspicion of. Once those monies have been blocked, it's untouchable. It sits in the bank account. It's like frozen. The account owner cannot access the money. Any interest earned on that money keeps on getting credited to the account. And then we follow due process. We allow the account holder or the involved party to make their representations. Because it's a civil administrative action, we have to allow them the opportunity to state their case. Once that process has been completed, we would then do a submission to the Deputy Governor if we feel that we've got we've got enough evidence to go with for a forfeiture. So until that forfeiture is concluded, or until we uplift that blocking, that money sits, it's untouchable. If something goes wrong, if a bank by accident releases that money, the bank must just put the money back in the account. We're very strict on that. It's a very powerful regulation. So we apply it with the necessary diligence, but once the money is blocked, it cannot be moved anywhere. If it is moved, it's unlawful, it's a criminal offence. We'll go after the parties that actually authorised the release of the funds. And just there was a question on the 100 million threshold for the interagency working group. We only refer matters to the working group that exceeds 100 million. In our own investigations, there's no threshold. Whether it's 100,000, 200,000, 10 million, 20 million, we try and investigate each and every case, and you'll see from our blockings that a lot of our blockings are for matters that's probably below the 100,000 threshold. But there's also some cases that are above that. And they're not all referred to the interagency working group, because we look at the criteria of the working group. And then on the universities, thank you for that suggestion. It was the first time we were requested by a university, and it's probably because many of our investigators have gone on that training. We will now seriously consider looking at other tertiary institutions, once they open again, to see if we can maybe present a further awareness session at other universities. But it's a very good suggestion, and we'll make work of that. Thank you.
Can you speak to the suspects that have been remanded in custody, whether they are still in custody? And then Dr. Masiabat.
In terms of IFF 1, the specific case is quite a complex matter. It involves about 800 investors, so there's quite a lot of investigation that need to be done by the hawks on the matter. And what happened in this matter, the guys fled the country, and they were circulated on the border post. When they returned to South Africa, they were arrested, and they were then released on bail, and the case was remanded to May of this year, of 2020. So the case is ongoing, and the prosecutor is currently busy drafting the charge sheet. As I'm saying, it's quite an investigation in terms of the number of investors involved and in terms of bank accounts involved in the matter. And just in terms to add, in terms of the university, from the financial intelligence side, we also been invited to some of the universities to present on their courses in terms of investigations, where we present about the topic on money laundering and the financing of terrorism, and in terms of our powers. We sometimes find that we attract possible people in terms of that when you start presenting on these initiatives to the universities.
No, thanks, Chair Director. Honourable members, I just want to come back to the threshold issue and just talk about the model itself so that you will be assured in terms of how we work. Remember, the inter-agency working group effectively means mainly the coming together of these structures. So the actual work in terms of investigative work, even on illicit financial flows, literally, it is located among all of the members of the inter-agency working group. So the model works this way. practically, or for example, as my colleague has just said from the Reserve Bank, once there is a particular case located at the Reserve Bank, for example, about contravention of exchange controls, when the Reserve Bank is starting to do that work, when they pick up that within this particular case there are issues that actually touches on poker, which is more, for example, on money laundering issues and all of that, they also get to realize this issue now touches on the issues of tax evasion, then it moves into SARS. So the moment they start the investigative work, then they pick up that this particular case is becoming more complex and broader. It involves, actually it starts to touch beyond their area of work. Then having done the preliminary work, they therefore present it into the inter-agency working group. So that is basically how the model works. Similarly, if something is being dealt with by the Hawks, still on illicit financial flows, doing criminal investigations, when they pick up that there are issues now about exchange controls, which is then SARS, there are issues about tax evasion, which is now SARS, then they are able to see this one then deserves to come up into the inter-agency working group. But in the context, trying to contextualize it in the context of the threshold. So there is nothing that is effectively going to be falling off the radar or off the cracks. The only difference why we try to have a threshold is for the purposes of ensuring that those issues that are more complex, that are more of higher value, therefore we have to all come together, and that is how the context of illicit financial flows actually comes in. And by the way, the same model is used by the ACTT, the Anti-Corruption Task Team, in terms of corruption cases. The rest of the stakeholders who have corruption mandate will deal with everything, but those that are 5 million and above, and there's a criteria, they elevate it to that level, and then they do a collective work on it. The only different part is, if we can have an inter-agency working group on illicit financial flows, and we say we deal with everything, the difficulty of that operationally is that you have investigators who are having work that they need to be doing departmentally. So they cannot effectively then come together to address everything in that collective work. Hence, they sit in their respective areas to deal with their ordinary work based on their legislative mandate. And once it becomes cross-cutting, then they elevate it up. And that is how we do the coordination. But nothing is left out. So that's basically the assurance I wanted to give the committee members. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'll make a few remarks in response to some of the questions specifically, and then I thought that I'll just share some slides also about the areas where we are focusing on. I think, honourable members, it's maybe just important to note that our work isn't always triggered because we suspect a criminal event or an illicit flow. Our work is often just triggered by the way we risk profile, starting with a potential tax liability, and then as we develop it, it may then take us further down a route of criminal investigation. So as far as SARS is concerned, we don't differentiate between tax evasion and illicit flows necessarily, although they represent aspects in their own right. A good example thereof would be in instances where a importer of goods or services apply to the Reserve Bank for an advance purchase for capital goods, for example, machinery or equipment that they import into South Africa. They would pay an advanced amount. They would apply to the Reserve Bank for that amount. That would then be reconciled when the goods actually are imported into South Africa and the importer discloses it via a customs declaration, at which point we then often see a discrepancy between the amount of money that has been applied for and have flowed offshore and the value of the goods that then flow onto into the country. And part of that would be just a pure money laundering, pure getting money offshore through an inflated value, but it could also be a customs under-declaration, and we often see significant discrepancies in that regard. And we are clearly, in fact, we have been involved in discussion with the Reserve Bank, and we will be starting a pilot to improve the exchange of information between ourselves from what is currently a manual exchange of information driven by an incident to a more real-time and automatic exchange of information that allows for continuous looking for discrepancies in that regard. So that would be an example where we would start with a customs declaration issue, but we may end up in an illicit flow expression. Just to some of the specific questions, SARS currently, in terms of the illicit economy, in one area we are involved with 18 projects that involve 756 independent or connected but separate investigations where we believe the total revenue prejudice of these cases is close to 30 billion rand. Examples of what would be in that bucket would be two tobacco cases involving 103 investigations that we believe has a compromise of just over 14 billion rand. We currently have 530 million rand just unrecovered debt from the sector. Cash and carry is another example where we are involved with one project. We believe as a revenue compromise of 3 billion and already reflected on our book as potential debt is 4.8 billion. Specifically linked to illicit flows, we are currently looking at seven projects where we believe there's 6.4 billion of revenue compromise and 2.5 billion of revenue already on reflecting in our debt book. So that gives you an example, just I have more detail around that, but an example of some of the projects in total, as I said, 18 projects, over 750 cases, and close to 30 billion. Some of these areas we have completed investigations and recovered 237 million to date, and assessments raised of a further 367 million in the current year. Current investigations also highlight potential additional findings of 1.8 billion rand. These are investigations in progress. The first two are investigations we've completed. We've also engaged in the following enforcement activities: issued warrants of execution to the value of 65 million, sequestration or liquidation applications to the value of 539 million, preservation orders of 790 million and personal liability of 130 million. Around each of these, as I said, we have more detail. I give you an example where we need to step up our information exchange, and I'll share with you two examples. China is our largest trading partner. We see significant information asymmetry between the goods that China exports from their shores and the goods that we are declared as imports of a value of about only 67, say two-thirds of the value that China exports declares. We declare only 67% of that on the import. So there's a big information discrepancy. We have in place a, and as I said, this covers both areas of customs undervaluation and trade mispricing, but also embedded in this is illegal financial flows, either flowing out of our shore because of the mismatch between goods declared on the import and advanced purchase agreements. We have a mutual administrative assistance agreement with China that we have recently realized we haven't enforced as adequately as we ought to. So we have begun to step up our efforts through the Chinese embassy and with the assistance of the Minister of Trade and Industry to get a better exchange of information. And this was as a result of our inability to enforce our matters, because we can't, when we go to court, we don't have evidence of the real value. In one example of a set of consignments that we have currently under investigation, I give you a sense of the potential of revenue compromise. In this sample of consignments, we were now able to get information from the Chinese authority, and we compare that for the same goods that have been declared by the importers on the inward declarations. 7% of the value that is exported is declared as customs value on the import, which means that 93% of the value is underdeclared, and therefore the revenue compromise is significant in this regard. That's just one example where we are suffering revenue prejudice. We will, separate from this, we will also be, as part of our reporting to SCOF Chair, we will put together a comprehensive report when we report on our year end of the work that we have just done this year, as a separate and very specific focus of the area for reporting. But the presentation I will share with you just gives you a flavor of what we are doing, and then also areas of concern where I will conclude with where I believe we can do better and the areas that currently hold us back from doing better. So if I go to the second slide, you can see there we look at illicit trade, and on the right-hand side the connection to the flows. There is the value I referred to early on, the 18 projects of some 764 active investigations of around 30 billion. These are indicative numbers. We personally believe that when we have done all the work we need to do, those numbers will be significantly bigger. We conservatively estimate that as a combination of illicit flows and criminal activities, our revenue compromise is at least 100 billion rand once we continue to do the work. The total impact of the work today, as I said, is 1.42 billion. That refers to 460 million of cash that we have actually collected, preservation orders of 480 million that we have put on hold in lieu of debt that is owed to us, and proven claims of liquidated assets of 529 million. And we, of this, we have referred 20 cases to the law enforcement agencies. On the next slide, I give you also our engagement with the Zondo Commission and the Mpati Commission. We've received 179 requests for information that involve 1,385 taxpayers with almost 3,000 linked entities. 24 of these cases involve 350 entities that we are currently investigating or in various stages of audit. And to date, just from this, we have laid 19 criminal charges to the respective revenue agencies. The next slide gives you just areas that we are currently under our on our worksheet, if I can call that. In other words, all of these are work in progress, but I can share with you, for example, you will know that we, through the approval of the Minister, we have reinstituted the Davis Tax Committee. We are working a lot closer with the committee. They are embedded in our operation. We've allocated specific SARS resources to work with them, and in fact, I have a meeting this afternoon with the judge, and we will make an announcement of that work later this year, in which we will also disclose our assessment of the current tax gap that we currently are experiencing. But to give you a flavor, in transfer pricing, which is also It's a tax evasion mechanism, but effectively it achieves, first of all, illicit flows, a flow that goes offshore that is not due, but more importantly, over the long term, it begins to erode our domestic tax base. So transfer pricing, for example, we know that just in 2017, 93 billion of rands left our shores just through mainly three areas of work which relate to service charges. That would be commissions that are paid from South African-based subsidiaries to offshore parent companies. It would include management fees that are charged, royalties, and we have seen a significant increase in interest charges from the local subsidiaries to parent companies. In fact, in that 93 billion, 31 billion, a third of that just relates to interest charges. You will have heard in the minister's announcement that a significant focus is being placed in terms of the policy review of what we consider to be unhealthy levels of gearing, where debt is raised in the name of the local company, but in an offshore jurisdiction, which then is normally a commercially acceptable arrangement, except where the levels of gearing is unhealthy, high, in other words, debt-to-equity ratios, and also where there isn't necessarily a true commercial reason for raising the debt. Our conclusion is there can be no other reason for it than flowing funds offshore and for eroding our tax base. And so you will have noticed that for this year, the policy is that we will reduce the amount that companies can claim, but in the long term review the overall use thereof, but also the overall policy framework. Item number three, as I said, is the initial estimate of 100 billion. I've shared with you cases under review that refers to the 30 billion, but we believe there are still areas that we are not covering. I have to say we are simply scratching the surface in this regard. We cannot claim any victories as far as this is concerned. And then there are general areas of compliance. On the next slide, we try to give you a sense of specific areas and the initial values that make up some 90 billion of revenue compromise. I give you a moment to read that, but in international taxes, in VAT leakages and effective tax rates abuse, we see about 10 billion. In terms of revenue leakages due to syndicated fraud and other non-compliance areas, we see undervaluation of imports of around 8 billion. We see fraudulent refunds that we've had prevented of 25 to 30 billion. And we've done some work to give you a sense that relates more to fraudulent activities, but we've done some work where we've used elementary artificial intelligence and better use of data. And just in this year, we've stopped 600 million of outflows that is not permitted, and we've recovered 500 million of additional taxes just by stepping up our ability to do data matching and using elementary artificial intelligence. Clearly an area of work that we have to step up. So those are the examples of revenue. Successes against that in the current year is on the following page. And you'll see there we have recovered in this year's revenue amount an additional 12.3 billion through enhanced efforts that we are currently engaged in. I think those are some of the slides I wanted to share with you, just to give you open up the lens into the work we do. But as I conclude, Chair, areas of work that we believe we need to step up through the Global Tax Forum, we have an arrangement with 160 countries for the automatic exchange of information where individual South African taxpayers have financial assets, banking accounts offshore. We have currently active exchange of information with 93 of those countries. Through that, we have become aware of 3 million South African taxpayers who have financial assets offshore, and we currently need to step up our work to determine who of that universe have legitimately declared and disclosed that they have these assets offshore, and who of them have not disclosed them legitimately. From an earlier voluntary disclosure program, 3,000 individuals applied for voluntary disclosure, and through that we raised 4.4 billion rand in an earlier tax year. So you can see there's huge opportunity there and an area of work that we need to step up. Where do we have areas of improvement in the way we work? In the capability area, I have to say to you, we need to build deeper capability within SARS, investigative and audit capability, to step up the amount of resources we can apply to this work. We are not adequately resourced in this area. I said to you, we need to step up the use of data, of technology, data exchange, but also the use of data through machine-based artificial intelligence, and it's an area of work that we are looking at within SARS. We are in the process of appointing a chief data scientist to work with that. And then also just the way we work, we need to step up risk profiling and case selection within the institutions, but also between the institutions. We had a meeting between ourselves, the SIU, the NPA and the FIC a week ago to see how we can better select cases so that if we have high priority cases, we all don't go off in different directions, but we work on the same high priority cases and therefore leverage our effort more appropriately. So that's an area that I think we can improve at an interagency level. The last point around the threshold, I believe that we should not be sharing our thresholds publicly, because as the Honourable Member Abrams, I think, pointed out, people then arbitrage that. So within SARS, we don't disclose our risk profiling thresholds or criteria. We also keep it dynamic. In other words, we change it all the time so that the thieves don't really understand or know what our levels are. They try hard to hack into it, but if we keep it dynamic and constantly changing, then we are better able to detect and enforce. So, Chair, those are the things I thought, both in line with being part of the interagency working group, but also specifically within SARS, the efforts that we are engaged in and the early successes that we are already seeing, but also how we believe we can improve our way of working. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Commissioner, for the additional information. Do we have follow-up questions? Okay, you are covered. I think members will need a comprehensive report that Honorable Abrams probably will have to get a slot in plenary to present the report, like other committees present their reports, whether on oversight work or... This is a very, very important item, because as of now, when we are dealing with budget, this is a matter that is raised from time to time. But if you don't have facts, you just speak in general terms that we are losing a lot of money in illicit financial flows and all tax evasions. And somebody say, but what are you talking about? How much are we losing? And ask, from which competent authority do you get this information? So we've got state organs which have been established to deal with, amongst other things, people and companies who evade paying taxes or complying with the laws of the Republic. So they are a source of information to Parliament. It's like institutions supporting democracy. They have been established to create capacity for them to deal with specific issues. Also, they have a responsibility to work directly with Parliament so as to enhance Parliament's oversight responsibility. And here in Parliament, we have got an office specifically for ISD. So I'll say, members, probably a week, next week Monday, you won't be done with this report, Advocate, I'm not sure. Because we need a comprehensive report with statistics. Not only narrative. We need the narrative, but with numbers. So that it's not just like we are concoctioning a political report ourselves. You are competent authorities yourself. You have been appointed in these entities on the basis of your capacity and you are experts in your own right. So it will be important that we get a full report on illicit financial flows and generally tax evasion, Commissioner. Because this is the committee that play oversight on these entities which are here and those which are not here. So that we don't have many reports. Of course, you come to us individually when you come and account quarterly or once a year or annual report. But this is a project that has been initiated by the previous committee. And it can't just be like we wanted to listen to you from here, it ends here. We can't. This is a very important work for Parliament to know about and take decisions as to who should do what. Because you have got regulatory bodies and you have got law enforcement agencies. That this is the situation, the overview, get into detail. And you recommend what needs to be done by the law enforcement agencies. You play your regulatory role, but you can't go around arresting people. You don't have those powers. But we have the hawks here who are police, who have SIU and others. They've got the responsibility to arrest these people. So we will need that report so that we are able to explain to the public as to what is the impact of illicit financial flows and tax evasion on the economy of South Africa. Because as of now, with this corona virus, it means we have to readjust the growth projections. If the projection was 0.9%, I think by today is something below 0.4. Coronavirus will have a serious impact on the economy of the country. Already, the hospitality industry is crying because they rely on conferences, meetings, weddings, exhibitions. That's how they make money. So they are in the business of meetings and conferences. So once you put these restrictions, it will have a serious impact and it will affect the whole economy. If we say people from China and all those big countries should no longer come here for some time, if you go out of Parliament, in the main, you see them walking around here with tour guides. A majority of them is those that you see in that in those red buses. So it means for, I don't know for how long, we'll no longer have them. So these are real facts, things that you can see. You don't have to be an economist. So above what Corona is doing, we've got people who are evading taxes and taking money out of the country and receiving money from outside. Whether they are funding terrorist movements, we don't know. Because today, in north of Mozambique, we have got terrorist activities. So I will suggest members that the team which has been appointed, they can also rope in other experts to draft a comprehensive report for Parliament. You submit it, then we'll take it through the processes of Parliament for it to be a report of a National Assembly, and it be adopted. So that once it is adopted, you are able to follow up and enforce that you must do the following yourself, and why are you not doing it? So if it's not adopted, we'll have a problem of enforcing ourselves or playing oversight on a regular basis. It will like any other report. So we are not lecturers. We are not at the university. The university is around the corner here, UCT, where they just pick up a theme and they discuss. From there, after lunch, they go home. Because that's their business. They are in the academic sector. They are not law enforcers. They are not regulatory bodies. Theirs is to produce knowledge. Who wants to use that knowledge is none of their business. They produce knowledge and publish it. So we are not in their space. We are in the space of representing the public. And the public is complaining about money which is going around unaccounted for. So I'm not sure how long Advocate Kanyile, Reserve Bank, Hawks and SARS, whether we'll give you 2 weeks so that you can even consult other bodies like organized business. They've got lots of information, chambers of commerce, like you quoted BAT. You remember last year, last time when we did the public hearings, British American Tobacco Company came with information as to how much illicit cigarettes generate and all those. I don't know how the methodology they use to come to that conclusion. Their methodology has to be tested so that we don't take figures which, if somebody disputes them, we look like we don't know what we are doing, because Parliament can be it cannot be accepted that Parliament report things which are wrong to the public. It must be information that is properly edited. So I don't know how much time you'll need for this report so that you can come back and present it, and then we take it as a committee through the proper channels, commission works.
Chair, thank you for that, and also for highlighting the urgency of the work we do and the impact on our country. Without detracting from the importance of this work, I would like to seek your indulgence to give us time. The next 2 weeks, SARS will be focusing every ounce of our effort to collect the revenue for the last 2 weeks. So from our perspective, I would ask if we can plan for a month from today for a report to be submitted, if you think that that's reasonable. We would like to improve the comprehensive aspects, as you point out, that it's not just wild brushes, but wild strokes, but very specific information that is available at us and very specific actions that we are working towards addressing this. But I'm in your hands as far as that's concerned.
Rob Brahms, recommendation as they indicate the scope of work. How much time? Maybe end of April or when? Because SAR said in 2 weeks' time they've got another commitment.
Chair, I thought that this is work already done. Hence, I thought your request for a week was fair. But if SAR thinks that it's too soon, at least they could be given a fortnight to deal with it. Because already, from their side as well, I think it's work already done, Chair. I don't know if I'm being unreasonable, one of the members.
Thank you, Chair. I think perhaps they should advise, because we are now going to present the report to National Assembly, and the way I listened to Chair, he said what we need is to have, you know, real facts, and you also have to check them. You know, he gave an example of the tobacco that we have to test if the figures that they have mentioned here are correct. So then I think perhaps it's better if you advise. If you can give you the time frames here, then you will come back and say we did not give you enough time. And, well, of course, it doesn't have to be long because already you are presenting today. So some reasonable time.
Today is it the 17th? So when is Good Friday? Is it the in the 10th? So obviously it has to be after Easter. Hello. In terms of official program of Parliament, we are back on the 14th. I think let's give them up to the end of April so that we have a comprehensive report. I'm not sure whether that's too long. Honorable Abrams, you're suggesting a fortnight, which is exactly fortnight is when? It's two.
End of April is more than a month. That they are asking for.
Is the 17th.
So they could bring the report by immediately we come back by the 17th of April.
Okay. The 14th is a Tuesday, yeah? So the 17th, I think, is a Thursday. Is it a Thursday or Friday? It's a Friday. The week that we return here in case the president does not extend the state of disaster. So let's agree on a month from now, which is the 17th of April. Of course, we can't expect law enforcement agencies to say we're going to do the following, because that will compromise their work. You know, criminals are always ahead of police and regulatory bodies. So we'll expect the law enforcement agency to say we'll arrest people. And it ends there. Because it can't go into the details how you are going to intercept them at the borders, how you will follow them through cyber. I don't think we need that report. That's another very sensitive area. But at the end, it should say law enforcement. You'll see how you coined that statement so that it gives confidence to the public that the police will arrest these people who are evading taxes and who are involved in illicit. But the rest of you can go into details. And we don't expect names of people and companies. It can compromise Parliament. That you can do yourself, like SARS. They say they know 3 million people who have got assets out there. It's up to you to follow them. But for Parliament to know that there are 3 million South Africans who have got assets, it's important, who are not complying. Because all of us, when we go to SARS, we are asked how many cars, how many what. If you don't declare, you know the consequences. So why these rich people are not declaring? So let's agree that we'll meet on the 16th probably, or 17th, which is a Friday, for you to officially table that report, and then we'll take it from there. Thanks.